Thanks, sir. You would think that David Hoole is 100 years old for all of the stuff that he's done. Listen to this. He's a futurist, a strategist, and a speaker. He has been called the CEO's futurist, having advised or spoken to close to 2,000 CEOs and business owners in the last 4 years. I take it they were not all in the same room. He's regarded as the emerging global futurist today, having spoken on 5 continents in the past year and delivered 350-plus speeches in the last 48 months. He spent 20 years in media, entertainment, and technology. In fact, he was part of the executive team that launched MTV, Nickelodeon, VH1, and CNN Headline News. He's won 2 Emmys, a Peabody, and was nominated for an Academy Award. He's futurist in residence and faculty member at the Ringling College of Art and Design. He is a first-time guest. He is David Hoole. His book is Entering the Shift Age, 2-Minute Warning. And how about those Ravens? He's up next on Coast to Coast AM. Happy Saturday night, everybody. Welcome to the program, David Hoole. I feel I should address you as Lord Hoole, because, good Lord, you've done so much stuff. It's absolutely amazing.
Well, you've got a pretty long bio yourself.
Well, you know, half of it's made up. I've got a feeling that yours is real. You know, in the introduction of your book, it says, are you unsettled? Do you feel anxious about the future? Why does everything that used to work no longer work? And the way that things used to be now feels long gone. Are things getting better, getting worse? Are your children coming of age at a wonderful time or a horrible time? I think it's a wonderful time. It's a scary time, but it's wonderful. What do you think?
Well, I obviously think it's a great time. I think it is and will be looked back upon as one of the most transformative times in human history. I mean, it's a great time to be alive. You know, a lot of people try and get scared of change. And, you know, the first thing you have to say is the only constant in the universe is change. So if you're scared of change or you get fixed or you resist change, you're going against all the forces around you.
Why do you think people cling to, is it just fear of change? Is that the main thing that makes us just want to, we don't, seems like the human being doesn't want any change.
Well, I think that's generally right. Fear, it's fear-based. In my book, I talk about legacy thinking. In other words, that's why this decade, 2010 to 2020, is going to be such a transformative time, because a lot of legacy thinking falls away. So legacy thinking is the thoughts that, say, you've had in the 20th century that you still have today. You know, you can see that in Washington and dysfunction. They still are talking about presidents of the last century, and yet the world situation is so changed, you can't go back and look at them. So I always say to audiences when I speak, you know, what is it that you hold to be true? And when did you first think that? And if you thought it in 1990 and it's 2013, might it not be a good idea to check and see perhaps that you're, you know, filtering out too much information because you're holding on to some out-of-date worldview? So I think it's discomfort, too, and it's also a little bit of ego, like, this is what I believe to be true, and this is my opinion. And once people start holding on opinions, they stop paying attention to what goes on around them.
Now, how does a man become a futurist? I mean, obviously a futurist is one who tries to determine how our future is going to unfold before us. So what do you do, how do you do it, and how'd you get into it?
Well, there's about 5 questions there, so I'll start.
I know it.
Okay. It's been something that's been lifelong. As I look back at my life, and I'm a senior baby boomer, I realize that I've always been fascinated about the future. I've always done things before other people did them. I've always wondered what the next big thing was. And so, you know, it's kind of a through life attraction. I've been kind of attracted to what's going to be next and what's the next big thing. And you mentioned I was part of the team that created and launched MTV. So, you know, back in 1980, I was like the number one sales guy on TV and CBS in Chicago. I got a call from a guy. This is back when cable only had 10% penetration in households in the United States, who said, you know, we're thinking of launching this music channel. And I said to myself, okay, so it's 1980. So over the last 20 years, 1960 to 1980, what were the two most dominant forces in American popular culture? Rock and roll and TV. How could this not work? So, you know, at the time, I took a 50% pay cut, and people said, you're nuts. Cable's never going to, you know. And then fast forward to the 90s, where I was part of, I ran a company that was one of the first companies to create online courses the colleges, and this is back in the late 90s, and I can keep giving you other examples. So the first part of the answer is all my life I've kind of been oriented that way. And, you know, what I define as the future is what I, the way I define what I do is I'm a catalyst to get people, companies, the markets, and the world to think about the future and then to facilitate a conversation about it. Because a lot of people don't really think about the future, or if they think thinking about the future is thinking about their plans. As, you know, John Lennon famously said, life is what happens when you're busy making plans. And, you know, so they think it's personal or it's negative, or they don't think about it at all. So as a futurist, I try to take as my responsibility to get somebody who thinks the future is all about them to let go of that and realize that there's forces that are affecting the world and may affect them in the next few years is much more important than any of the plan that will affect their plans. For those people that think it's the future is negative, I try and show them that it really is transformative, as you started out, you know, I started out saying. And if you don't think about the future, I say, well, you know, you should think about the future, because if you don't, it will happen unto you and you'll get whacked. You know, and I started my blog Evolution Shift 7 years ago. My first book, The Shift Age, came out 5 years ago. And as you said in the intro, you know, I think it's up to around, you know, between 350 and 400 speeches in the last 4 years, you know, on all six inhabited continents. And so that's the other thing, John, that allows me to be fairly accurate in my forecast. Like, you know, you think far afield because you have guests on every week. But most people, you know, they're into this office job, or they're into selling this product, or they do this or they do that. And I kind of skip around all around the world and in different industries and different associations meeting. So I kind of get an overall picture, whereas most people are just, you know, in their vertical silo. So, you know, that's one of the attributes I can bring to people.
Well, that's very interesting. So really, you obviously like variety, and I suppose that the future would probably offer the most variety.
Well, yeah. I mean, I have a low boredom threshold, and I, you know, one of the things I say, so people say, so how do you do your research, you know? And I do research in the sense that I read widely. I got about 150 to 200 inbound, you know, newsletters, research pieces and stuff every day in my inbox. I don't necessarily read it all. I think I'm probably one of the most superficial intellectual grazers on the planet, because my job is not to master a specific topic, but to try and see the overall trends and connect the dots that other people don't even see and then show them that connectivity. So I'm just, you know, I wrote a column once about the accuracy of my forecast. And in a way, you know, all your listeners know what that feeling of deja vu is, that you've been here before. But oftentimes I feel as though I'm living a deja vu life, you know, like in 2006, I said that by 2008, oil would be $125 a barrel. And this was back when it was $50. I was laughed off a TV show. Right? So then when it was $147, it's kind of like, well, I told you this was going to happen. Yeah, so it's kind of an odd, you know, disassociative connection to the reality, to the present, because I'm living it before it happens to some degree.
You know, I really like that expression. I like the crystal ball. Yeah. Well, mine spends most of the time in the shop. You know.
Right.
Oh no! We're going to banish that expression. Mm-hmm. I'm doing it. We went round and round over this expression, you know. I used to drive my dad nuts with that, and then I started doing it again, and you did it too. So anyway, I love that expression that you have, intellectual grazing. I must borrow it, David. And someone asks me, what do I do? I'll say, well, actually, I'm an intellectual grazer. That's beautiful.
Well, I used to always put the word superficial in front of it. I travel a lot, right? So I'm in airports. To sort of give, you know, your listeners an example, I'll go into it. If everybody just thinks about what happens when they have some time to kill and they go into one of those newsstands where you can get snacks and stuff to drink and magazines, and right. You see people picking up a magazine and looking at it. What I do is I stand in front of the whole newsstand and I just look across it. And I kind of go, okay, so now we're worshiping the god Kardashian this week, you know, or whatever it is.
Yes.
Try to get an overall view of what's going on in society.
Isn't that funny? It seems like Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie were on the cover of at least one tabloid and as many as three for about 5 years. I mean, every day. You couldn't go anywhere without seeing them there. I got a completely amazing publicist.
Exactly. Now, two things about that. The pair, you know, Marx in his writing said, you know, religion was the opiate of the masses. And I like to paraphrase that and say, in the United States, sports, consumerism, and celebrities are the opiate of the masses. You know, and it's true. All you have to do is look around you, and, you know, it's like, you know, have you ever been to Pompeii? It's a city outside, you know, the one that got destroyed by the volcano outside Rome.
I have not, but that's definitely on the list.
Yeah, so you go there, and it's like the civilization frozen in time, right? I mean, one day it was a thriving civilization. The next day it was covered in volcanic ash, and it stopped. And I always think about that image. Like, what if that were to theoretically happen to the United States of America today? You know, 200 years from now, the archaeologists would say, well, God, they were worshiping this god called Brad Pitt, this goddess called Kardashian, and there was this group of gods who'd fallen down called the Los Angeles Lakers. You know, I mean, whatever it is. And it's just, when you look at it from that way, you realize that that's why I think people get scared of the future, because the future is real. And a lot of people like to just go through life distracted.
You know, I touched on this a little bit earlier, David, but what do you think is this fixation on celebrity? I mean, does this mean that the people who are seeking a celebrity to admire, are they just putting in their time down here on planet Earth until, you know, checkout day? Or, I mean, it seems to me that the more things that you are handed by way of distractions, the fewer choices you make, because they're actually subconsciously being made for you.
I agree with that. I absolutely agree with that. I mean, it's the... And I think that celebrityism, if that's a word, is much more prevalent now. I mean, there were the stars like the Cary Grants and the Gregory Pecks and the Marilyn Monroes. But people get, you know, I think this reality TV stuff. I think part of the answer is people kind of, as you say, like to give up their authority to others. You know, you see it everywhere. I would never wear a sports jersey with somebody else's name on it. I mean, my name's David Hoole. You know, I even take it to an extreme. My name, you know, I like wearing vests and jackets, but my name isn't the North Face, and my name isn't Abercrombie & Fitch. It's David Hoole, right? So, you know, back in the day when I was a kid, that was called advertising, you know. And now it's, oh, I'm a North Face person. I'm a Nike person. I'm a Lakers guy. Whatever it is, you know, and if all of that energy was put towards world peace, where would we be, you know?
I ran into this kid some years ago, and he was of that age that they take on little nicknames for themselves, and he decided his nickname was going to be Naught, as in N-O-U-G-H-T. I said, you've effectively named yourself Nothing? And he said, yes. He was very serious about this, but at least he was honest about it. I mean, I think that reflected his view of the world, but... seemed a little sad.
You know, one of the things that I thought about, you know, in my first book and my new book, Entering the Shift Age, I talk about the threshold decades, 1985 to 2005. And I talk about the explosion of choice. And, you know, in that 20 years is when everything really exploded. You know, there were different ways you could listen to music, the different ways you could read books, a number of brands of toothpaste, the number of television channels, right? It exploded. And there is a psychological disorder called choice catatonia. You know, as in catatonic, which means that when confronted with choice, some people, for example, will walk into a modern-day supermarket and freeze and panic because there's too much choice for them. And I think that in 1980, and so it occurred to me, and this is like 6 years ago when I was writing the book, it occurred to me that from 1985 to 2005 was also the time where there was an explosion in membership of the fundamental arms of all major religions. You know, and I put the two together, and this may be the partial answer to the celebrities, is there's just too much choice. I can't figure it out. I'll do what the Quran says. I'll do what the Bible says. I'll do what my priest tells me to do. And they kind of give up their moral authority to somebody else because it's accepted and it's easy, and then they're part of a group. And I'm not saying anything negative towards religion. I'm just saying, isn't it interesting that when choice really exploded and connectivity really began was when the most conservative parts of the major religions of the world grew rapidly. You know, it's kind of counterbalanced in some way, perhaps.
That is interesting because, of course, to do something religiously just means to do it regularly. It doesn't necessarily mean make a ceremony of it. It's just what you do. I suppose you can make anything a religion. So maybe they made their choice. Rather than go to the sports religion or even the news religion, we'll go back to the spiritual religions.
Right. You know, or do what the good book says, as the Bible mm-hmm. says, as the Quran says, you know, and it's just, that's fine, but you're making a choice to no longer have to make a choice, right?
Right, exactly. Well, then tell us, what is the shift age? And are we very far into it, or is it just beginning?
I'm known as the guy who's coined that phrase. We've left the information age, and we've entered the shift age. And, you know, just to give a background on ages, the agricultural age began 10,000 years ago, where man literally put down roots and civilization began. And then 300 years ago, the invention of the steam engine, the industrial age began. And then loosely, you know, early 70s, 40 years ago, the information age began with communication satellites, computers, things like that. And in the beginning of this century, I sensed that something new was going to happen. We were entering a new age. And I went back and I read the great futurists of the last third part of the 20th century, you know, Alvin Toffler, Marshall McLuhan, Buckminster Fuller. And, you know, they've been so right about, you know, the last 30, 40 years of the last century, but they were kind of diffuse into this century. So that's when I started my blog. And I said, so what is it? Everything is shifting. And that's where I came up with the name. So we've left the information age. I said in 2007, there'd be about a 4 or 5 year reorganizational recession between two ages, because there's always kind of an economic disruption in the transition between ages, because business models change and other things change, technology changes. And so what the shift age is it's the global stage of human evolution. I mean, we've gone from family to tribe to village to city to city state to nation state, and the only remaining boundaries are now planetary. I mean, you know, I looked at, before I came on the show, of course, I looked at your bio. You've been in lots of different places. You know, you're not just in one town your entire life. And 300 years ago, that's what most people spent their lives, right?
That's true.
So I've come up with this phrase, you know, and then each age tends to have characteristics that define it. Like industrial age was defined by production and mass production, and the information age was defined by information and computers, and, you know, communications technologies. And the shift age is defined by three forces. I mean, I could give a long list, but I think the three fundamental forces that underlie all the change anybody listening to us now is feeling is, first is the flow to global. We're getting organized around a global construct, far beyond a global economy. In fact, most aspects of human society are going to be globalized. So globalization is no longer an economic word alone. So we're the flow to global. At the same time, because of this explosion of choice that we were talking about earlier, the power has moved from the producer to the consumer, from the institution to the individual. So we as individuals have more power than individuals have ever had.
And the third one, very quickly, before we got to take our break.
The third one is the accelerated electronic connectedness of the planet, which amplifies the first two, and we can talk about that when we come back from break.
Okay, it's a little bit of a long one, but let's catch up on those three items as we continue our visit with David Houle, entering the shift age. Hit third and punch it. This is Coast to Coast AM. Of course we can. We're doing it now. It's a beautiful thing. Sorry about the smack. I don't know what's going on here. But it's just such a savory conversation with David Houle, America's leading futurist. His book is Entering the Shift Age. And speaking of shifting, the radio landscape has continuously shifted. And will continue to shift, and you have shifted with it by becoming a Coast Insider. Thank you very much for that. For anybody who's unfamiliar with that particular little project, it's 3 years of archived programs, over 1,000 programs you can listen to whenever you want. And it's inexpensive, a valuable service. I'm sure you will like it. We'll be right back with David Houle as we carry on through Saturday night right here on the mothership that is Coast to Coast AM. All right, David Houle, would you just take us back to those 3 points and reiterate all three of them? Just bring us back to center.
Sure. The three forces of the shift age are the flow to global, getting organized around a new global construct. It's a global stage of human evolution. The second is the flow to the individual. Because of the explosion of choice, we as individuals have more power than individuals have ever had before. And the third, the one we didn't have time to jump into, is the accelerated electronic connectedness of the planet. And the simple best example of that are cell phones. There's almost 7.1 billion humans on the planet, and 5.6 billion of them have cell phones. You always hear the stories about somebody goes on safari and Kenya, and the guide gets a phone call. They're standing in a squalor of a makeshift village with no electricity and running water in South Africa, and they have cell phones. So the point to be made there is, let's say you have a cell phone and you were to call your engineer in the studio, who's probably 10 or 15 feet away from you. Cell phone to cell phone, it would go, 1-1,000, 2-1,000, 3-1,000. 5 seconds, his phone would ring. If you were to call China, another 12,000 miles away, it might be another 2 seconds because the relay of the satellite. So there's no time or distance limiting human communication. And of course, you get on the phone, cell phone to cell phone, one of the things you go, so where are you at? Or where are you, right? So there's no time, distance, or place limiting human communication. And that couldn't be said 5 years ago, let alone 25 or 100 years ago.
We seem to be numb to it.
We seem to be what?
Well, we seem to be almost numb to how wonderful it is. These were things when we were kids, it was just they were just dreams. We had no idea if this would actually happen, and it did. And now it's like day before yesterday's news.
Well, that's right. And the interesting thing that I tend to think about to try and show people just kind of adapt to technology, but they don't necessarily see how it is changing them or collectively all of us. But, I gave a TEDx talk, the TED Talks, 12-12-12 in Sarasota. And the title of the talk was "The Concept of Place Has Changed Forever." And what I mean by that is nobody listening here gets to choose their parents, which means you didn't get to choose where you were raised. And yet where you were raised really shapes who you are. The concept of place shapes us. If you root for the Boston Red Sox, it's probably because at some point in time you lived in Boston if you don't live there now, right? And so I put up a slide in that presentation, and I said, we all remember that we all studied the Roman Empire, right? Well, yes. At the same time there was the Roman Empire, there were two great dynasties in China, and there was the Mayan civilization in Central America. And they all existed at the same time, but they didn't know it because the distance kept them apart. I mean, up to 200 years ago, the speed of communication was a horse day, how far a horse could go in a day. So when you think about the fact that 200 years ago, that's how fast information could travel until the telegraph came along.
Yeah.
And then you realize that all these civilizations, what would happen today? We'd know about what's happening in China within 24 hours, right? So it really, so this connectivity is changing us much more profoundly than we're aware of as we, slide the apps around in our app phone.
Art Bell years ago wrote this book called The Quickening, suggesting that all of the events, all of the event components that make up human existence, or at least our perception of it, were accelerating. And, what is your opinion? Are things actually, it seems like things are getting much faster. There seems to be less and less time to do anything, and yet we're busy all the time.
Yeah, well, I do think that things, the speed of change has been accelerating so much that it is no longer a dynamic. We live in an environment of change. And I think I know you have a lot of listeners in California, and you know, whenever I travel around the world, I say, raise your hand if you've ever been in an earthquake. And of course, in California, everybody raised their hand. And the point I make about that is, no matter how long ago it was, you remember it as though it was yesterday. A profound force affected you, and you know, the ground shifted underfoot. So I always say to somebody who is resistant to change, if you're so sure you know you're standing on solid ground, and you have certainty that you're right, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, 2 years from now, you're going to wake up and go, what happened? Well, I was so busy being certain. You know? So I really think that we live in an environment of change. I think that it's happening so fast. I mean, the amount of change in a lifetime today. I mean, the baby boomer was the first, baby boomer generation was the first generation that really experienced the magnitude of change in a single lifetime. And it's gotten ever faster. You know, I wrote in my book that my grandfather grew up with candlelight and horse and buggy. And my grandchild, you know, assuming you have them, will have stuff that I can only imagine. And that's just three generations, right? It's amazing.
Yes, it's amazing just how few generations would carry us all the way back to the American Revolution, just seven or eight.
Well, think about this, okay? So that's a very good point, Jen. Modern man, the current iteration that we represent, has been around for 150,000 years, okay? So if you accept for the sake of easy argument that a lifetime is 50 years, we obviously live more than that now, but centuries and millennia ago we didn't. If a lifetime is 50 years, then 150,000 years is 3,000 lifetimes. 10,000 years, all of recorded history in the agricultural age, is 200 lifetimes. So for 2,800 lifetimes of modern man, we lived in caves. 200 lifetimes, we created all the great civilizations of the world. Industrial age, 300 years, right? Six lifetimes. Information age, 40 years. One lifetime. So you just see how it's accelerating. That's why I love being a futurist, because you know, I have to move real quickly. You know? I mean, I forecast stuff. I mean, I made a forecast, you know, and I was, you know, that something would happen by 2014 and it happened to 2012, right? So, you know, it's that dynamic.
You know, just a couple of guys talking here, David. We didn't get a chance to speak before the program. And by the way, I'm delighted that you consented to do this interview as a first-time guest, because I knew this was going to be interesting the moment that I saw your book. What about people who are, I mean, isn't there going to be some considerable expenditure of energy, mental, and maybe even physical to kind of get in the groove and get with the shift thing? And what becomes of those who don't shift with it?
Well, you know, it's an individual thing. I think that the attraction of something new, we've all been raised on new, improved, right? So I think that we're all kind of drawn to the new. So that kind of is an attraction. I think that there is a point that we are now crossing where the speed, the rapidity of technological change challenging some people's physiology or ability to think. And nobody has to change if they don't want to, but they have to accept the fact that if they choose not to change, then things will pass them by. I mean, there's a lot of people that just want to go off the grid, quote unquote, go live in some beautiful, nice place and not be, and that's fine, but you can't do that and then expect to come in and be knowledgeable in what's going on. You know, it's just, it's a torrent. You know, here's a statistic that staggered me when I figured it out for my book. And it's a conservative. So, you know, depending on the source, you know, there was 3 to 10 exabytes of information created from the beginning of time, human time, to the year 2000. 3 to 10 exabytes. In 2010, humanity created 4 exabytes every 3 days. Think about that, right? Now, a lot of this is useless information we never see. But I think that you and I are process and assimilate multi-sensorially more information now than our grandparents ever could. So,
well, that's very interesting. And that spawns a bunch of questions, sort of like one of George Hart's mentors at MIT called information disease. Maybe there will be a sensory disease as well. I mean, it's hard to predict what the human mind is going to do in dealing with this future. I mean, what next? Transhumanism. I mean, we're going to the stars, finding all this space junk up on Mars, and we got the government weirdness here, and we got society is like, what are we going to do about the disenfranchised ones? What are we going to do about this? I mean, for example, I mean, one guy running around on a vendetta out in California has got, you know, half the state in a twist. And I'm just wondering how this is going to play out psychologically to people, or on people, rather.
Well, first of all, we all, you know, if you followed any basic neuroscience over the last 30 or 40 years, it's generally accepted that we consciously use a small part of our brain. That the amount of computing power in the brain that we fully are aware of and utilize is small. And there were some interesting studies that were done. So I talk about generations in my book, and I call the children born since 1997 digital natives, right? In other words, they're the first generation born into the digital landscape. For them, it's their native landscape. You and I are immigrants, and anybody over the age of certainly 20 is an immigrant into the digital landscape. So they did this test once. It was about 4 years ago, and the test was, you know, the concept of doing search, like actually searching with the internet, you're actually using your brain a lot. Which one do I click on? Where do I go from here? Which is the right one? You're constantly having to process fast decision making, right? So they had a control group of people over the age of 60, people between 40 and 60, people between 20 and 40, and then people under the age of 12. I think that was roughly it. I may have some of those, you know, the groupings wrong. And the control was on a Monday morning, they tested brainwaves, what the activity of the brain was. And then they made each of those groups do 1 hour of real focused search where they had to find something and get something and do it. And then they measured their brainwaves. They did it for 5 days. And at the end of the fifth day on Friday, every single category of demographics had increased brain activity, except for the digital natives, because they started with a higher level of brain activity and kept it constant. So the children that are born into the digital age since 1997, in other words, they've never not known their parents not to have cell phones, they've never not known a computer now, they've never not known the internet, they've never, for the most part, particularly if they're born, you know, close to 2009, they've never not known touchscreen TVs or touchscreen tablets. They have more. They have 3 to 7% more synaptic activity going on in their brain than older people do. So to your point, this whole new generation born into the digital landscape, you and I are talking about information overload. Go ask an 8-year-old, how you deal with information overload? And they'll look at you like, what are you saying? Right? I mean, how is a 3-year-old who's on an iPad now going to show up as a 20-year-old? It boggles the mind when you really think about it.
Yes, it does. Well, how do you see the future of education? I'm hearing things like they're taking nonfiction out of the curriculum, which I think would be a tragedy, because that's where really dreams are born, is in reading these fanciful stories written by really good writers. And then I understand that in some schools, even cursive writing is not taught anymore, because so much keyboard action is in progress in the classroom. So how do you see our kids being educated in the future?
Well, I wrote a book a couple of years ago called Shift Ed, A Call to Action for Transforming K-12 Education. And the fundamental point of that was that the word reform, like school reform, no longer cuts it, because it's a broken system. It has to be transformed. So in my new book, Entering the Shift Age, in the chapter I have on education, I talk about it, you know, and at every single level, there's going to be huge change. In the preschool, what I was just talking about, you know, you have kids coming into kindergarten, age 4 and age 5, that have been on an iPad or computers or various, you know, digital devices for 2 and 3 years. So they're coming in much more adept. In K-12, it's going to be much more about, I find all around the country, schools are just changing, and they're letting connectivity in, and they're letting kids move at their own pace. I think, and I've been saying this recently as I've been, you know, doing some media interviews here this past month, that higher education is the next big bubble in this country. There was the tech bubble, there was the real estate bubble, and now there's the higher ed bubble. And if you think about it, what do they all have in common? A rapid run-up in price, a huge amount of debt on the buyer side and the seller side, and a product that is increasingly less valuable through time. So I think one of the things that's going to happen in higher ed is that there's going to be a separation, a bifurcation. You know, you've probably read about these things called MOOCs, M-O-O-C, Massive Open Online Courses. And to use MIT, Harvard, and Stanford have just done this over the last year. So you've got three of the best universities in the world who've taken their best professors and videotaped their courses, and they've put them online. So as a parent, you go, I've got a bright kid, and to send her to MIT will take $250,000 for 4 years. Or maybe she's so bright that she could take 125 credit hours or whatever it is for a four-year degree through the video, take the test, pass, and instead of getting a diploma, get a college certificate and pay $25,000. And if you think about it, and, you know, universities are always trying to raise money. They're always trying to compete with, you know, very fancy facilities. And they've lost their way in terms of really teaching. And I think that there's going to be a whole new model. I mean, think about it. Hey, gee, we can accept 1,000 people and charge them $50,000 a year, or we can reach around the world and get 100,000 people and pay $10,000 a year. You know, what's $10,000 for a degree, excuse me. So higher ed's going to get disrupted. K-12's going to get disrupted. And it's going to become much more digital, much more technologically oriented. And, I mean, I can go on for this for a long time, but you know, one of the great, I think I mentioned Alvin Toffler before. I stand on his shoulders. He's my conceptual ancestor. And he has a great metaphor that I use both in my education book and my new book. And it's kind of like the metaphor is, okay, there's a cop standing beside the social highway with a radar gun. And here goes the American company at 100 miles an hour. And here goes the American family at 60 miles an hour. And here goes education at 10 miles an hour. And, of course, you know, the Senate, the Congress, and the president at 3 miles an hour, right? So for the last 50 to 75 years, education, K-12 education, has been going at one-tenth the speed of the corporation. So how can we – that's why there's the skills gap you read about. Because education is so hidebound, tradition-bound, and really, you know, there's going to be more change, John, in the next 10 years on all levels of education than in the last 50.
Excellent. Well, let's just hold our horses for a second. David Houle, first-time guest on Coast to Coast AM. Entering the Shift Age is his book. His websites are davidhoole.com, that's H-O-U-L-E, and also www.evolutionshift.com. Check them out while you listen to these messages, and then come back. This is Coast to Coast AM.